Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. midterm elections is upon the U.S., and the Republicans are almost certain that they will take back control of Congress. Meanwhile, this has been called one of the most important elections because the U.S. has never been so polarized. How severe is this polarity, and will it impact these elections? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why many Americans may not even accept the election results, an approach used by the former U.S. President Donald Trump, which has given rise to what's called political violence.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Richard Becker joins us. He's an anti-war activist at the Answer Coalition who joins us from San Francisco. Also joining us, James Jatras, former U.S. diplomat who joins us from Belgrade. Welcome to you both. James Jatras, first over to you. So we have the midterm elections. What do you think? They say it's going to be all about the economy, since Americans are dealing with inflation and high living costs. How much do you think the vote is going to be about that or about the current U.S. President Joe Biden?
Well, I think those two things go together. The fact that we have a totally incompetent president that's visible for the entire world to see, plus a very bad economic situation and inflation by all accounts, should mean a fairly decent night for the Republicans. And not only would the Republicans certainly take the House of Representatives, but very likely would take the Senate at all. But I think there are a lot of signals being sent, particularly by the Democrats, that that may not happen. I mean, Joe Biden doesn't sound like a man who expects to do badly in these elections. Rather than making his pitch to the American people, rather a few days ago, he went out and essentially threatened them and saying that if people don't accept the results of these elections, they're basically fascists, or one of his officials was speaking to Congress and saying essentially they would be agents of the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians if they don't accept the elections because they're fascists. It's very, very strange that somebody who by all rights should be expecting to do badly in an election is in a position of threatening his political opponents as, in essence, foreign agents and traitors if they question the election results. And I think we're already seeing some indications, for example, in the Senate race in Pennsylvania, which, again, by all rights, the Republican Mehmet Oz should win, that Mr. Fetterman, his opponent, the lieutenant governor, who's you know, again, it makes even Joe Biden look like a competent person, is saying that he expects the Republicans to have a really good turnout today, but over the next days or even weeks, that he expects to come out on top. So I think there's a lot of very interesting and concerning signals that are being sent.
What do you think about what our guest there from Belgrade, James Jatras, is saying there, Richard Becker, in terms of how Joe Biden has said what he said? I'm sure you heard him. What do you think that means?
Well, I don't really agree with that. I mean, I'm not a supporter of Joe Biden, but I don't think Biden was threatening to manipulate the election results. I think that has been the Republican strategy over a long period of time, is to put people into place such as secretaries of state, which are there. There's a secretary of state in each state of the United States, and they are responsible in most cases for running elections. The Republican strategy has been to get people into those positions who have taken the position that the 2000 election was illegal, that it was not, the outcome was manipulated, and so forth. So, I mean, the problem with Biden and the Democrats is that they have they've squandered their opportunity to a very large degree. They have, since the Democrats took control of the House and Senate as well as the White House in the 2000 election or following the 2000 election, they have failed to do what they said that they were going to do. They failed to carry out a program that could have really won them the support.
Why do you think that happened?
An unbeatable majority. And they, because instead of being able to carry through that agenda, they focused on things like Russiagate, so-called, I mean, these kind of ridiculous things, and that they have, as a party, are so divided among themselves that they've been unable to pass the program that has been had been proposed to relieve the suffering and meet the needs of the people.
Well, when you say a party that's divided, and you talk about how they've had their chance, and that now there's a missed opportunity because, as you mentioned, the focus on Russia. First of all, what issues are they divided on that stands out so glaringly? So, as you, for you to say that, I mean, in that respect, then this party, even if they retain the House or Congress, they're not going to be able to move forward that well if what you're saying is true.
Well, you know, what they're not divided on is war. The so-called Progressive Caucus in Congress, in a very mild statement a few weeks ago, where they first of all said that they were they praised Biden and the White House and the Pentagon for pouring weaponry into the to Ukraine to carry out what is really a U.S. NATO proxy war against Russia. And they said, well, maybe we should have negotiations too. And they were attacked by the leaders of their own party. And these are all Democrats. They were attacked by the leaders of their own party for even suggesting that there should be negotiations instead of all-out military campaign until victory.
Sure.
At the cost of every, unlimited numbers of Ukrainian and Russian lives.
Sure. Well, this notion of democracy is something that the U.S. President Joe Biden said on the eve of the U.S. midterms. And the statement that he made is, we know in our bones that our democracy is at risk. And we know that this is your moment to defend it. So let me, James Atross is back. James Atross, Joe Biden's statements about democracy, how it's, we know in our bones that that it's at risk. And it kind of goes along with what you said, James Atross. But you would think that the stance that you made, if I'm interpreting it correctly, is something that the Republicans would kind of say, alluding to voter fraud, I'm guessing, based on some of the statements. How do you see this statement by Joe Biden vis-a-vis, of course, the Republican stance altogether?
Well, I took it as a threat. You see, here's what the paradox is that Biden is calling his enemies extremists in every respect. And the fact of the matter is, even if most Republicans think this, wrongly or rightly, even if most Republicans think there was corruption in this election and the election was stolen, just as many of them think that the 2020 election was stolen, Republicans are not going to go out on the street and burn things down the way Democratic supporters burned the country down in 2020 during the BLM riots. So there's this interesting paradox where one side engages in violence and has no consequences for it. The other side doesn't engage in violence, but is treated as enemies of the people. We've seen, for example, the politicization of the FBI and of the justice system to basically take care, to treat opponents of the Biden regime as enemies. And I think, as you started the program, this is an indication of just how polarized this country has become. But the fact of the matter is, one side is using violence and using the politicization of the law enforcement structures of the federal government against its political opponents. The other side,
which side
to have no way to really deal with that.
Which side is doing that, James or Truss?
I think the left is doing that. The Biden regime and its supporters are doing that against their opponents.
Richard Brecker, I see you shaking your head. It's interesting that James or Truss says the Biden regime, by the way, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there were, after the murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police, there were demonstrations in more than 5,000 cities and towns in the United States. Less than 0.01% of those had any kind of violence, and there was no violence that ended up with people dead except at the hands of the police. And so now, on January 6th, that was not the left that stormed the Congress. That was the right wing, and led by fascist forces like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. They played a key role in that. I mean, this is your other guest is presenting a new falsification of history. And the reality of it is that the violence that's being threatened now is violence that's coming from the right. And it's people out like today in Arizona with automatic weapons at polling places intended to intimidate people and prevent them from voting. That's happening in many places across the country. That's what's the real threat of violence is coming from the fascists.
James Ross, go ahead.
Well, this is a perfect example of what you're talking about at the beginning of this program. Americans simply do not live in the same country anymore. We have a very polarized society where we are effectively morally aliens to one another, if not enemies. And there's nothing that's going to change that through an electoral process. And the fact of the matter is, I have to dispute what my opponent says, that the truth, in 2020, during those mostly peaceful riots that burnt out the middle of many American cities, about 60 people died, and they were not killed by the police, who basically allowed them to do whatever they wanted to do in Democratic-controlled cities. Only one person died on January 6th, and that was an unarmed woman shot by a policeman.
Richard Brecker.
You know, again, here you have a mass movement, the largest mass movement in U.S. history. 34 to 35 million people participated in those protests, and they were not riots. They were protests against police brutality.
They were riots, and by the way, the police did not kill George Floyd.
And you can't change that.
He was a criminal who died of a fentanyl overdose. Everybody knows this.
Richard Brecker.
Oh. Really, it wasn't the knee on the throat.
No, because he was saying I can't breathe while he was still standing up and not getting in the police car. He's saying I can't breathe while he was standing there. Somebody who can't breathe is not saying I can't breathe.
Okay, so we're seeing right now the breakdown amongst you two to be representative. I'm guessing a mirror image of what many Americans think about each other. And it's interesting that you say it's not that James Atrasi said that you were living amongst aliens in the States, as you mentioned, but you're living in another planet. How did it get to the point where the polarization is not so much an exchange of thoughts as what many polls are indicating that this has to involve some kind of violence? And the reference is being made to the most recent incident that happened with Nancy Pelosi's husband. I mean, where does that line get crossed where violence comes into the picture in the States in this case?
Well, I think let's take this Pelosi thing for an example. All the indications we've seen is that this unhinged gentleman who was caught in this very odd situation with Mr. Pelosi was some kind of a LGBT nudist activist of some sort, very much on the left wing if he had any politics at all. He seems to be a rather flaky individual. What kind of relationship, if any, he had with Mr. Pelosi, I don't know. Yet this is somehow being turned into by the mainstream media, which is essentially regime media that's in the pocket of the big corporations that, oddly enough, left-wing people in this country now support because it supports all their rainbow, homosexual, transgender agenda, which they want to impose on this country and, let's be honest, on the rest of the world. That somehow we've got woke capitalism in a kind of a fascist relationship with a left-wing regime that wants to suppress the American people, who are mostly passive, are not doing anything, are not threatening violence, but are being accused of being violent extremists.
You know, there's some points
That's
of views there.
In this position.
Thank you, James Atross. Richard Becker, some points of views there that James Atross has relayed, from LGBTQs to, if I said that correctly in that order, to the other opinions that he just said And again, these are things that he said, that the left-wing regime, I guess, is what you said, is being exercised on the Americans. Do you feel that way? Do you agree with that?
No, not at all. And the person who attacked Nancy Pelosi's husband was a left-wing conspiracy theorist, of who they are, who evolved into a right-wing, an extreme right-wing conspiracy theorist. And that's why he carried out the attack that he did. And that's why he carried out what he was hoping would be an attack on Nancy Pelosi. And again, I'm not a supporter of Nancy Pelosi or the Democratic Party, but I think that there's no question that that's what happened. And this idea right. that there's a homosexual agenda is complete. That's a theory that has no
Richard
basis
Becker, quick question. Why isn't anybody for Nancy Pelosi? It seems like that's something that's been going on for quite some time.
Well, she has her supporters. As I said, I'm not a Democrat, but there are, you know, there's a very large Democratic Party that does support Nancy Pelosi. And the person who attacked her and who sought to attack her and did attack her husband was not from the left. He was a person who had been persuaded by these conspiracy theories, but somehow there was this agenda that was going on, and it was meant to turn everyone into pedophiles or something. I mean, it's complete garbage. It's just ridiculous garbage, but mm-hmm. that's what's being passed around as a real political outlook.
James Dutras, go ahead if you have a reaction.
Yeah, it's a conspiracy. Huh? Just Google drag queen story hour. Just Google family-friendly drag queen shows and seeing what's being normalized in American schools, telling kids that they should dress up or transition, as they say, into another sex. This is being supported by the Biden regime. I do call it a regime, by the corporations. And this is America's agenda abroad. This is what we're trying
percentage?
To force on countries. We talk about countries like Ukraine, for example, talking about countries in Eastern Europe, in Serbia, where I am at the moment. This is the kind of agenda that this sick regime is trying to push on the American people and on the rest of the world. And a lot of ordinary Americans don't like it. And my only complaint is, we don't know what to do about it, because we're talking about honest, law-abiding people, family people, married people with kids, church-going people who don't like these kind of values.
James Dutras, when you say that, what percentage, if you were to take a guess, unless you know a solid fact from a source, does America fall into the lines that you just said, that are for or against what you said?
Well, see, that's the trouble. I think we don't really know. I think, unfortunately, it basically breaks down to about half and half, with more extreme elements on either side. I would say more people on the right side are basically just sort of normal people who just want to live their lives and not accept this agenda. Is that a majority of the population? Probably not anymore. Maybe 35, maybe 40% of the population, but maybe another 10 or 20% will vote along with them. Same thing on the other side. I'm sure you have some very radical fringe on the left that espouses all of these values, but another 30, 40% of the population will vote along with them because they think they're voting for compassion or tolerance or any of these things. But the bottom line to me is that which side is the big money and the political power on? It's on the side of the left.
Mm-hmm. Some of the things that Richard Becker, obviously, that James Dutras said, I'm sure would not fly in San Francisco. But since we just have a few minutes left over here, let's move on to the foreign policy arena and see what's going to happen there. I mean, if all indications come out to be true in terms of the Republicans taking control of the Senate or the House or both, what are we looking at when it comes to, for example, issues like Iran?
Well, unfortunately, there is a bipartisan foreign policy of the United States, and it's an imperialist foreign policy. And so we have Trump having, in regard to Iran, having shut down, walked out of the JCPOA unilaterally, really a violation of that treaty. We have Trump having increased the imposition of sanctions, 243 new sanctions on Cuba, causing great suffering to the people, and increasing the sanctions on Iran, doing the same thing. But then you have Biden, when he was running, said he was going to change those policies, and he has not. So there's no new JCPOA. There's still sanctions on Iran. There's a maintenance of the sanctions blockade against Cuba. And there is foreign policy that is getting bipartisan support for the U.S.-NATO proxy war against Russia, a war that really threatens the whole world with nuclear destruction, and a war that needs to come to an end, and can only come to an end not based on a decision by Zelensky, who I think is the president of Ukraine, who I think is just a puppet, but it's the refusal of the U.S. and NATO to negotiate, going all the way back to last year,
okay,
when there was an opportunity for that, and instead has fueled this war. And that's a Republican and Democratic joint project.
Keep hearing about Republicans, James Atras, that are going to tone down the aid, military aid or assistance overall, perhaps, to Ukraine. Are we really looking at that happening? Were they to take control?
No, I don't think so. And this is where I do agree with my colleague on the program, is that we do have two warmongering parties. And even though I think there will be more Trump-type mega populists who are being demonized by the other side, they really are the only ones that might be somewhat opposed to some of this stuff. But even they will be a tiny minority in the Republican office holders. The leadership will be even more warmongering than the Democrats are. And of course, the left wing of the Democratic Party that used to be a peace wing of the Democratic Party has totally collapsed. We had that fiasco a few weeks ago where a number of left wing members, you know, the progressive bloc in the House, had written mildly urging negotiations and were forced to retract it because their betters in the party, I guess, held them down. So it's really sad. We have some populist right opposition to these things, but it's very small, and it's not really going to have much of an impact. My only fear is that the Republicans take the Congress, that they'll simply demand even more money for Ukraine, more militancy in global affairs. So unfortunately, I think my colleagues, he and I agree on this.
Okay. Final question. I see we have some time here. I'm going to go back to what you had a UN special rapporteur say back in the year 2020, where he decried near tyranny in U.S. against minority voting rights. Richard Becker, electoral laws in some part of the U.S., like Texas, may undermine democracy by depriving millions of citizens the equal right to vote. Are we going to look at that happen perhaps this time, or is this a norm? Or what do you think about this? Again, this was something that came out based on a report back in 2020.
It's very widespread, and it's aimed at particularly at black voters, also Latino voters, to restrict their access to voting. After years of expanding the access, now there have been in many states restrictions that have been put into place. And I think this is because the right wing can't really win the elections anymore if everyone gets to vote. You know who said that? Donald Trump. He said that a few years ago. He said, if we let everybody vote, the Republicans will never win another election. So the strategy is, let's shut down voting rights. Let's make voting more difficult. Why does voting even take place in the United States on a Tuesday, today? Why not and why isn't it a national holiday? So, because it makes it so much more difficult.
Let me give 30 seconds to James Atras. James Atras, in closing, anything you'd like to say?
I would agree with my colleague on moving elections from Tuesday to a Saturday or a Sunday. If he will agree with me that people to register to vote must not only provide proof of their identity, but proof of their citizenship, which simply does not happen. What he talks about, what ballot security measures are designed to make sure that people who are voting are actually citizens of the United States and actually who they are, who they say they are. Instead, what we get is the massive dumping of mail-in ballots,
right,
which is an open recipe for fraud.
Thank you, James Atras, former U.S. diplomat from Belgrade. Richard Becker, thank you. Anti-war activist, Answer Coalition, San Francisco. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the effects of faith. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the effects of faith in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that Iman, which is known as faith, it is related to the beliefs that we have. Therefore, it is said by Imam Ali alayhi salam that al-Imanu ma'arifatun bil-qalb. Iman, faith, is something that you acknowledge with the heart and you accept it with the heart. Wa iqrarun bil-lisan, and you confirm it with your tongue. وَعَمَلٌ بِالْأَرْكَانِ, and it is the practice of what has come in the Islam. And in the other hadith, he also said, أَسْلُ الْإِيمَانِ, the essential of Iman or the faith is حُسْنُ التَّسْلِيمِ لِأَمْرِ اللَّهِ, that we are submissive to all the orders of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When we practically do something, when we practically practice Islam, then obviously it can be said that this person has become a mu'min, or he has faith, he is faithful. Therefore, there are some effects of Iman. And the very first effect which we're going to talk is that when someone becomes a believer and he gets to the status of Iman, he gets to the status of Iman, he has the feeling of love towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and towards the world, which is taking him near to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So the very first thing is that we can see that the people who are faithful, who has Iman, they never commit suicide. They never become depressed. They are not upset. Yes, there are hardships. There are things that comes in their life, but they take it as a trial and they show patience. Therefore, because they are warm, their hearts are warm of the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, therefore they tackle all these things very easily. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the effects of faith in the Islamic lifestyle. And therefore, we mentioned the first effect, that the one who is faithful, who has reached to the level of Iman, he basically is the one who has, whose heart is warm with the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And therefore, he knows the love of Allah. How is it? The second effect is that he has a peace of like the peace, the spiritual peace, we can say, the peace in his spirit and in his body. His body feels peaceful when he is reached to the Iman. Why? Because when he performs something, he knows that I'm doing this for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He avoids to perform bad deeds. He avoids the evil. And even if in some case he is committing a sin and he has done it, he immediately performs, seeks forgiveness from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He repents to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, he knows the way that by mistake, if he has committed a sin, how to ask for forgiveness from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, this brings peace for his spirit. He is close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The way it is said in the Quran that Allah bidhikri Allahi tatma'innul qulub, in chapter Ra'ad, verse number 28. Allah, let it be known that in the remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there is a peace, tatma'innul qulub. It is a peace for the heart. Therefore, his heart is full of peace and he is always in the state of peace. He does not need to go to exercise something, maybe like, you know, in today's world, in order to get the spiritual peace, people go for yoga, they go for other kinds of things, and they try to have exercise. Yes, exercise is necessary for the body, and that gives strength to the body. But on the other hand, for the spiritual peace, when you're connected to God, when you're connected to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then obviously this connection brings peace to the hearts. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
U.S. President Joe Biden recounted his trips to Afghanistan in a recent speech to war veterans, including one in 2008 in which he was stranded in snow. In his remarks, he repeatedly disparaged Afghanistan as a godforsaken place. The Taliban say his words are out of frustration.
We don't know on what basis they've stated such a thing, but Afghans continue to live their normal lives. There is no need for the U.S. cooperation and help. Such statements are made out of frustration and envy. In any case, God willing, Afghans live their normal lives and build their country themselves.
People here say nearly two decades of U.S. presence in Afghanistan didn't have any positive impacts on their lives. They say the American forces committed countless war crimes and destroyed basic infrastructure in many areas.
The U.S. has not served any country it has entered. The U.S. considers its own interests wherever it goes. There is no improvement in the lives of Afghans, as you see, and people are poor.
The U.S. was in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now Biden says Afghanistan is a godforsaken country. The main factor to that is the Americans themselves who created disorder in this country.
The U.S. ended its occupation of Afghanistan in August 2021, but shortly after that, the Biden administration imposed sanctions on the country and froze billions of dollars worth of assets belonging to Afghanistan, leaving the country in a difficult economic situation. People say the ongoing war in Afghanistan is an economic one. Many are striving to survive while billions of dollars of their assets are frozen by the U.S. Abdullah Mirzad, Kabul.
It is blatantly obvious that Brussels is losing its energy war with Moscow as prices across the 19-country eurozone continue to skyrocket. Washington is benefiting by selling gas to the EU at a high price. Eurozone finance ministers met on Monday to assess the crisis.
We are focusing now also within the European Commission, within the General Council, how we can, and then also with the ministers of energy that are focusing on how we can reduce that cost in the near future.
The poorest are feeling the pain most. Eye-watering amounts have been spent to try and compensate.
Euro area governments have so far collectively spent about 1.25% on energy supports for the year, so about 200 billion euro.
Of course, it's all linked to the EU's attempts to isolate Russia over the war in Ukraine. It's costing EU taxpayers billions of euro to house Ukrainian refugees, supply weapons to the Ukrainian army, and fund the government in Kiev. Ordinary workers will have to pay for it, but the eurozone economy is beginning to flatline.
Inflation continues to be high, even surprisingly high for both Europe and the United States. Sentiment indicators are very low, indicating a risk of recession.
It appears the European Union is now in damage control mode.
I am telling that we can work, should work, to avoid that this is a prolonged period of recession.
Peace activists are calling on the EU to mediate between Russia and Ukraine, but those calls appear to be falling on deaf ears. Many people are now nervously wondering, is there an unemployment catastrophe looming in the Eurozone? Whether they are being overly pessimistic or merely realistic, there's no doubt a growing number of economists are suggesting the Eurozone is heading for a deep, prolonged recession. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A string of humanitarian groups have slammed the Italian government for breaking international law after pushing back over 200 asylum seekers who were trying to reach a safe port in Italy. Two rescue vessels, the Humanity One and the Geo Barents, had docked in Sicily on Sunday, carrying hundreds of asylum seekers. The most vulnerable ones, women, children and ill people, were allowed to disembark. But 35 men on the Humanity One and another 215 on the Geo Barents were told to stay on board. That was made possible by the Italian authorities hastily adopting a new decree which has introduced a selective approach in deciding to disembark from the rescue boats. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni had put migration flows in the spotlight during her first trip to Brussels last week, when she asked the EU to help handle asylum seekers' arrivals on Italian coasts.
Our priorities are shifting. Italy's approach to migration will now be to defend its national borders. The matter is highly sensitive, but many EU leaders have agreed with me on this issue.
The Humanity One said it would launch legal action against the Italian government, claiming Rome's decision to not let all the asylum seekers disembark violates European law and the Geneva Refugee Convention. Meanwhile, two other boats run by non-governmental organizations remain at sea, with no ports willing to accept them. In 2017, the Italian government signed an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government. The deal, which is still in place, provides that Italy and the EU help the Libyan Coast Guard enhance its maritime surveillance capacity by providing financial support and technical assets. In practical terms, under the deal, every asylum seeker intercepted at sea ends up in a Libyan detention center where torture, sexual violence and abuse are practiced.
The European member state and its citizens have been manipulated by few political heads. They do not know the facts, what is happening on the Mediterranean, what are the causes why people are forced to migrate. So when we tell this story, when we try to approach, when we try to unveil these realities, what is happening in the concentration camp in Libya, people will wake up.
Since the start of the year, about 180,000 asylum seekers have reached the EU on boats, up almost 90% compared to the year before. We are in the middle of the biggest mass migration in Europe since the end of World War II, and as distasteful as it may sound, that's also a huge business opportunity. An increasing number of people believe that refugee flows keep pouring into the old continent for the greed of those who exploit asylum seekers for profit in and outside Europe. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran has unveiled the Bavar 373 missile system with a range of over 300 kilometers. Moreover, the Sagyad B-4 defense missile production line was also inaugurated on Sunday in a ceremony attended by Iran's defense minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at the range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at the range of more than 300 kilometers.
Bavar 373 missile system has successfully hit targets at a range of 305 kilometers. This missile system has been designed to counter long-range targets, ballistic missiles, warplanes, and bombers. Even many technologically advanced countries aspire to have such a high-tech missile system.
The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers.
The missile system has been totally produced and upgraded by Iranian specialists at the Defense Ministry and the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have been able to upgrade the range of this missile in only 2 years. This shows that we can counter all kinds of threats by using domestically made defensive equipment. As much as the threats advance, the Bavar 373 system and other air defense systems advance ahead of their current threats.
The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement height has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers. In the past couple of years, Iran has reached self-sufficiency in manufacturing different types of missiles to boost its defensive capabilities with the aim of protecting its territorial integrity and national sovereignty. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Shortly before their midterm legislative elections, a stunning new poll shows that 9 out of 10 Americans are afraid of politically motivated violence. The blame is apportioned in almost equal thirds. Democrats blame Republicans, Republican respondents hold Democrats responsible, and another third says both parties are equally responsible.
Neither party is actually putting forward any platform for actual unity across race, gender, class, etc., religion, and you know, it's a necessary outcome of just the decades of politicization and really the political moment that we're in right now, where you know, there's a fascist movement in this country.
There have been 10 times the number of threats against members of Congress than there were just 5 years ago. The arrival of the corrosive Donald Trump and the seemingly equally corrosive repression of his supporters has revealed a national political culture plagued by self-righteousness, anger, and violence. An extensive recent survey found that nearly a third of Americans believe that political violence is usually or always justified.
So I think the violence already is happening. I think it's the question of, you know, as we get closer to 2024, that violence is going to get turned up a dial. So I think it's really, it's sad, unfortunate, it's terrible, but I think it's a consequence of, you know, what the ruling class has actually, you know, fomented.
The poll was taken shortly after the in-home attack on the husband of the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Many are shocked that the nation's vast and armed-to-the-teeth security services couldn't adequately protect the home of the nation's number three post. The incident continues to be the subject of salacious allegations, which have been exacerbated by the Pelosi's refusal to release their home security footage, as well as the refusal of local police to release their own body camera footage. The suppression of news reports on the incident has further inflamed public opinion. Polls repeatedly show that Nancy Pelosi has the lowest approval ratings of any prominent member of Congress. Pelosi's have been recently accused of insider trading, and the extremely wealthy family is often criticized for flaunting their affluence. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Unaffordable rents, choosing between meals and heating, and tears when the bills arrive. Some of the issues that have drawn thousands from across England to the capital on this rainy day.
Concerned about the future, they're protesting against what they see as years of government inaction. It has led to a deepening cost of living crisis, a squeeze on people's finances, and pushed public services to the brink.
Organized by the People's Assembly, they've named the demo Britain is Broken, a name that captures the country's multiple crises. The government blames the emergency at home on the crises abroad, such as the war in Ukraine and global energy price hikes. The protesters here say it's all the result of more than a decade of conservative rule and that the time for change has come. The mass demonstration comes only days after the Bank of England increased interest rates yet again to control double-digit inflation. The new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, is announcing his economic plan later this month, expected to include increased taxes and cuts to public spending, meaning the outlook for ordinary Britons looks gloomier than it is now. Saeed Pereza, London.
An Islamophobia scandal now threatens a British student union following anger over the sacking of its female Muslim president amid allegations of anti-Semitism. Shaima Dilali was elected president of the National Union of Students in March. Dilali was initially hailed for being the first ever black Muslim female to take up the post. However, she was suspended from the role in July amid an investigation into anti-Israel comments she made up to 10 years prior to her election, including a 2012 tweet in which Ms. Dilali wrote, "Khayba Khayba, O Jews, Mohammed's army will return to Gaza," a tweet she has since apologized for. An NUS statement on the decision said,
"Following the independent King's College-led investigation into allegations of anti-Semitism, specifically into the then president-elect under the NUS Code of Conduct, an independent panel has found that significant breaches of NUS's policies have taken place. As per this finding, we have terminated the president's contract."
Dilali expressed further fury at the news of her sacking after she discovered it on Twitter, shared by a pro-Israel newspaper who may have been leaked the story prior to the NUS updating Mrs. Dilali. In response, Dilali has vowed to fight the outcome via a pending legal challenge alleging discriminatory treatment. Mrs. Dilali's sacking has sparked furious anger across the British Muslim community, who believe this is gross censorship of pro-Palestine activism.
Anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism is like comparing apples and oranges. This has absolutely nothing to do with the Jewish faith. Actually, it's the weaponization of the Jewish faith that we are seeing. What we are talking is a colonization enterprise. That is, the whole existence of the Israeli regime is a colonization enterprise. It's clear that the whole issue is to criminalize pro-Palestinian sentiment, which actually shows you how effective pro-Palestinian sentiment is.
Things could get very ugly for the NUS as Muslim student bodies are threatening a boycott and Dilali plans her fight back. The NUS has previously prided itself on being an inclusive environment for all and an advocate of free speech. However, they now have to prove that that is indeed the case amid racism and Islamophobia accusations thrown their way by the former president, Robert Carter, London.
The Pentagon has admitted that the United States has soldiers on the ground in the Ukraine and far from their embassy, a decision which drastically increases the chances of accidentally sparking an all-out war with Russia. The troops are allegedly only inspecting and doing a proper accounting of U.S. arms deliveries to Ukraine, but many have alleged that their actual role is to provide weapons training and perhaps more. The United States has already provided nearly $20 billion worth of military equipment to Ukraine this year. Both Republican leaders and some progressive Democrats have openly criticized the costly aid, which has only further escalated the conflict. It has already been widely reported that scores of U.S. ex-military personnel and retired officers are helping to lead the war from inside Ukraine. The Pentagon claims the so-called inspectors will not travel to the front lines, but that gives many little comfort.
I think they're acting very recklessly, and they're dragging us to something that could be completely avoided now that you have, you know, Russia saying, hey, we'll use nukes if you don't back off, right? And I think this isn't a war between, you know, Ukraine and the United States. This isn't a war between Ukraine and Russia. It's a war between NATO using Ukraine as a proxy to weaken Russia.
Washington has known for months that their weapons shipments went totally untraced once they entered into Ukraine. Not only does that facilitate Defense Department mismanagement and possible corruption, But the arms could wind up in the hands of far-right militias and be used to destabilize the area for years, as NATO weapons did in the Balkans and then Libya. U.S. weapons have already been found to have been illicitly diverted to Sweden, Denmark, and as far away as the Netherlands.
When you have the United States, when you have the Pentagon saying, hey, we're going to post all these long-range missiles on your border, Ukraine, so that you can reach Moscow in 6 minutes, obviously Russia is going to do something about it. So I think the United States foreign policy right now is essentially pouring billions into Ukraine, pouring like billions into mercenaries, pouring billion into this proxy war in order to weaken Russia.
With the U.S. kicked out of Afghanistan, illegally occupying northeastern Syria, and precariously perched in Iraq, many wonder if Washington and NATO have chosen the Ukraine for their new theater of war. Anti-NATO demonstrations across Europe have been violently repressed in recent weeks. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A new report by the Afghan Journalistic Center shows that at least 127 journalists and media workers lost their lives during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Investigations also show that in more than 90% of those cases, the ones responsible for the deaths were not brought to justice. The Association of Afghan Reporters is demanding the International Criminal Court to take a look into the killings. People are also asking the Taliban to stay true to what it has promised and show support towards Afghan journalists. That includes ending impunity for crimes against this group of workers who are constantly under danger in a war-torn country.
The U.S. started the war on Afghanistan and caused devastation and casualties. It should be held accountable for the death of all civilians, especially journalists, in the past 20 years. The International Criminal Court should investigate the killing cases of Afghan journalists and recognize them as international crimes. The families of a slain journalist should be paid compensation. Unfortunately, so far, not a single case has been suspected.
This comes as those 127 martyred journalists have been two honest and dedicated staff, Said Farhad Takaddousi and Habibullah Hussainzadeh, who lost their lives on duty in 2011 and 2017. The relatives and colleagues of the two continue to honor their memory.
Two of our colleagues at Press TV were among the victims of U.S. war on Afghanistan. Syed Farhad in 2011 and Habibullah was martyred in 2017, both on duty and in war incidents. They were so close to me and meant a lot for Press TV and the medium community in Afghanistan. Their loss should not be forgotten or ignored. We demand justice and compensation for their families.
The commemoration of martyrs comes as the Afghanistan situation is still tense for journalists. Rights bodies are calling for support and protection by the ruling Taliban and the international community. Due to war and insecurity, Afghanistan has been one of the most dangerous countries for reporters. And there have been journalists who gave their lives in the line of duty. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Limelight.
A new analysis finds that the U.S. war in Somalia was waged with no clear legal basis. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Intercept wrote, "The United States has fought more than a dozen secret wars over the last two decades, according to a new report from Brennan Center for Justice at New York University's School of Law. Through a combination of ground combat, air strikes, and operations by U.S. proxy forces, these conflicts have ranged from Africa to the West Asia region to Central Asia, often completely unknown to the American people and with minimal congressional oversight. This proliferation of secret war is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it is undemocratic and dangerous, wrote Catherine Young, a Bright counsel in the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. The conduct of undisclosed hostilities in unreported countries contravenes our constitutional design. It invites military escalation that is unforeseeable to the public, to Congress, and even to the diplomats charged with managing U.S. foreign relations, she added. These clandestine conflicts have been enabled by 2001 authorization for use of military force enacted in the wake of September 11 attacks, as well as the covert action statute, which allows secret, unattributed operations primarily conducted by the CIA. The United States has also relied on a set of obscure security cooperation authorities that The Intercept has previously investigated, including an expose earlier this year that revealed the existence of unreported U.S. counterterrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. A Bright document, so-called 127E programs, known by their legal designation in those countries, and 12 others, including Afghanistan, Cameroon, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Nigeria, Somalia, and Tunisia, as well as a country in the Asia-Pacific region that has not yet been publicly identified. The 127E authority, which allows U.S. commandos to employ local surrogates on U.S.-directed missions targeting U.S. enemies to achieve U.S. aims, is just one of the three low-profile efforts analyzed in the Brennan Center report. Another 10 U.S. Code 333, often referred to as the Global Train and Equip Authority, allows the Pentagon to provide training and gear to foreign forces anywhere in the world. The FAR Mercury 1202 authority allows the Defense Department to offer support to foreign surrogates taking part in irregular warfare aimed at near-peer competitors like China and Russia. The report released recently offers the most complete analysis yet of the legal underpinnings, congressional confusion, and a Pentagon obfuscation surrounding these efforts, and explains how and why the Defense Department has been able to conduct under-the-table conflicts for the last 20 years. The Brennan Center's report underscores the need to shine a light on the defense activities that have been cloaked in secrecy for too long. At the bare minimum, the public and Congress need to know where and why we are sending our service members into harm's way. Representative Sarah Jacobs of California, a member of the House Armed Services Committee, told The Intercept, adding, "I hope this report strengthens the urgency of Congress taking back its war powers, eliminating existing loopholes in security operations, programs, and ensuring our strategies match our values, goals, and commitment to our service members." Congress's understanding of U.S. warmaking is often no better than the public record, writes Ebright, adding, "The Departments of Defense diplomatic counterparts in the Department of State also struggle to understand and gain insight into the reach of U.S. hostilities. Where congressional oversight falters, so too does oversight within the executive branch." Ebright's analysis is particularly illuminating in the case of Somalia, where the United States developed two key proxy forces.